From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up, discussion of a government bailout for the big three auto industry has our listeners in an uproar.
But first, that discussion is taking place today in the Senate Banking Committee. The leaders of the Detroit automakers are testifying today. 2 weeks ago, politicians ripped them for arriving in private jets and failing to explain how they would fix their companies. This time, they've all submitted plans for survival, and they're looking contrite after arriving by hybrid car. NPR's Frank Langfitt has been following the hearing. He's here now. And Frank, how's it going so far?
Well, there's a real change in tone, Madeline. And this is good news, I think, for the automakers. I mean, last month, many of the senators, as you were saying, were really lacerating, and you could feel a genuine anger at the companies. Chris Dodd, he's the chairman of the Banking Committee, a Democrat from Connecticut. Here's how he opened that hearing about 3 weeks ago.
They are seeking treatment for wounds that I believe, to a large extent, were self-inflicted. No one can say that they didn't see this coming. Their companies have been struggling for years. Their boardrooms and executive suites, in my view, have been famously devoid of vision.
Now, today, it was a very different approach. One thing Dodd said is he now supports the loans to the companies, so that's certainly good news for them. And he praised them for coming back with specific, although what he said were imperfect plans. Here's how he put it this morning.
Some of the companies ought to be commended for going back to the drawing board, making tough decisions, and stepping forward today. You've come a long way in 2 weeks, I would say.
And Frank, so he is in favor, I guess, now of a bailout. How are the Detroit executives handling the hearing? What kind of tone are they setting?
Well, last month, as you were saying, many people saw them as arrogant, people, you know, the public, and evasive in their answers when they were being asked, well, what would you do with this money? This time, they're sort of sitting together. They're politely listening. As you said, instead of jets, they came in hybrids. And the GM CEO, Rick Wagoner, in his prepared testimony, he admitted that last month's hearing was difficult. And he said, looking back over the years, he had this admission. He said, quote, we're here today because we made mistakes. And what he says in his testimony is they failed to be a more flexible company, didn't move quickly enough to smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. And now the recession has them on a brink. And what he's asking for today from the banking committee is up to $18 billion in loans. And he says GM needs $4 billion of that this month. And this plea is a lot more desperate than the one he made just a few weeks ago.
And tell us more about plans that GM has unveiled as to how it would fix its business in the long run and go back to profitability.
Well, you know, on paper, these are pretty sizable changes. They're talking about cutting another 31,000 jobs, and that's on top of many cuts in the last two to three years, and maybe cut as many as 19 plants. They're talking about selling Saab and phasing out much of Pontiac. Some of the changes, though, are a bit vague, and it'll be interesting to see what the senators, some of the questions the senators ask and the answers they get. They're talking about Saturn as some sort of alternative for Saturn, but it's not clear what that means. As far as Chrysler, it's probably in the weakest position. It's asking for about $7 billion this month. Ford has a lot more cash. They're stronger. They say they could need $9 billion, but they might be able to get through the recession without it.
And the car companies are also looking for some union concessions, right?
They are. And yesterday, what the UAW said it would do is it would suspend the jobs bank, which has been very criticized by the public. This is where a lot of workers can actually get up to $28 an hour to do, frankly, crossword puzzles in strip malls. I mean, they sit around, they don't work. That's been very heavily criticized. And also delay payments for a health care fund that the UAW would run to get those health care expenses off GM and Ford and Chrysler's books.
NPR's Frank Langfitt covering today's hearing on Capitol Hill. Thank you, Frank.
Happy to do it, Madeline.
Also watching the congressional hearings on the Big Three bailout today is Gary Watson. He's a retired auto worker, and he joins us now by phone from a UAW hall in Lansing, Michigan. Welcome to the program, Mr. Watson, and can you give us a sense of what the mood is like there?
Well, I think everybody is kind of on pins and needles to see what's going to come out of it. See what direction Congress is going to go.
The union recently made certain concessions to help cut costs on their end, including suspending the Job Bank program, and that's a program where UAW workers can receive nearly full pay for up to 2 years if their jobs are eliminated. Why make sacrifices like that?
Well, I think the union's been a partner in this thing. In fact, I was one to help negotiate the Jobs Bank originally, so I pretty well understand that program, but we can turn this thing around. We can keep those working that are there today, so there may not be a need for it.
Of course, any proposed changes would have to be ratified by union members. What do you think the chances are there that, these changes would be approved?
I think they have put a scare into people enough that they'd approve almost anything, and that's unfortunate. But I think we'll rely on our leadership. Cal Rapson, who's our vice president, has been in General Motors his entire life. I've worked with Cal when I was here as a president. I think he understands the needs of auto workers, understands what GM can do and what they can't do. And I think if we follow his leadership along with Ron Gettelfinger, we're not going to be in too bad a shape.
You worked at a GM plant for 32 years. What you're seeing right now, how does that compare to what you've seen in the past? There have been troubled times before.
Never have seen anything to this magnitude. You know, my local's gone from 14,000 members to 2,000. When I was here, we were worrying about what was our next product, not worrying about whether we were going to have a product.
And so for some of the workers that are there now with you at this UAW hall currently employed, what are they talking about? Are they coming up with a plan B in case this doesn't happen and they don't have jobs?
Well, I don't think anybody at this point is going to panic to that degree. I think Congress has to come across with something that's going to solve and save the auto industry. I read an article the other day where it says, you know, the auto industry pays about $156 billion in taxes a year. If you can loan somebody $36 billion and get $156 billion back, that's not a bad investment.
Some might see it that way. Some look at other numbers and are a little less sympathetic to the auto industry. Sometimes people are critical. They say that union auto workers are paid too much. What, from your perspective, would you tell people who have that opinion? You say, look, guys working for Toyota don't get nearly as much in benefits. You guys should give up some more.
You can only get what you can negotiate from a company, and a company has to have something for you to negotiate it from. And that's basically how we got where we are today. We happened to work for three companies that were far and above probably most companies in America, paid their CEOs huge profits, huge wages, and, you know, we only negotiate our share of that. Now, if we have to give our share back to save that company, I guess that's something we got to do. You know, I guess America has to decide if they want an American auto business here in America or if they want to rely on China to fight a war in the event we have to go to one.
I'm curious, Mr. Watson, personally, what's at stake for you? You, I'm sure, still receive benefits from GM. Are you possibly sacrificing some things here, and what would that mean for you?
Well, yeah, we've had to pay copays on our insurance, which we didn't have to originally. I'm sure, you know, we would have got increases in our pensions had this not happened, if the corporations were continuing to make huge sums of money. So, yeah, I think everybody's ponying up a little bit. And you know, if you take a little from here and a little from there, eventually you got a lot.
Gary Watson is a retired auto worker. He spoke to us on the phone from a UAW hall in Lansing, Michigan. Thank you, Mr. Watson.
You're welcome.
Polls show Americans are divided over the question of whether or not to bail out the auto companies. Our listeners seem divided, too. Senior producer Steve Proffitt is here now to share some of your comments.
Madeline, it's a very polarizing thing, it seems like, this auto bailout. Listener Brian Witt wrote us in disgust. He's from Sterling Heights, Michigan.
And he's pretty unhappy with me personally.
Yes, personally. I invited Mr. Witt to read his comments, but he didn't respond. He accuses you, dear Madeline, of having some sort of vendetta against the American car companies. In the past weeks, he writes, she...
Meaning me.
Yes, you, has demeaned the retooling of Detroit's car companies, argued for the dissolution of the unions, and just attacked anyone who is contrary to her views.
Wow.
Mr. Witt concludes, go drive your foreign-subsidized Kia.
Well, if I had one, I would go drive it, but I don't have one.
Well, Madeline, others are also unhappy with the interview you did yesterday with the Michigan governor.
Yes, we spoke with Governor Jennifer Granholm. She defended the auto companies and argued for a government bailout.
And from East Lansing, Michigan, Ted Wilson wrote to agree with the governor's assertion that the recession will turn into a depression if Congress fails to provide loans to the car companies. We got quite a few other letters, most from Michigan, supporting the governor and the auto bailout.
But not everyone agrees with Governor Granholm that Congress needs to help the big three.
And they don't all hate you, Madeline.
This is Joshua Holcomb from Shepherdsville, Kentucky. I understand the governor needs to save jobs. It's just sad to hear her try to feed the public all the reasons why the current situation isn't the fault of the automakers. Her response has made me cringe.
Okay, let's move on to another topic now. On Tuesday, our pal Alex Chadwick updated a story he'd originally reported last summer.
And this was a story about a 16-year-old boy who is sailing all by himself around the world. He's trying to become the youngest person to do it.
That's right. He's Zach Sunderland, and he's posting stories about some of his adventures on a blog, zachsunderland.com. He's run into some rough weather, and he's even had an encounter with what appeared to be pirates.
And several listeners wrote in thanking us for the update.
But at least one wasn't happy that we continue to cover stories about kids alone on sailboats.
My name is Steve Side. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York. I live now on a 46-foot sailboat. I've read portions of Zach's postings, and he's frankly not equipped in judgment or experience to do this now. There are many better ways to develop and demonstrate his abilities.
And finally, Madeline, best pizza in Culver City, California.
Okay, you're referring to the story we did about voice recognition search software. This is where you just speak some words into your cell phone and then search Google or some other search engine.
Right, and we got a response from very, very far away.
Hi, this is Jake Reiner. I'm calling from the Earth Embassy on Mount Fuji in Japan. The voice recognition software in my car, if I just press a button and say sushi, the navigator will call out directions and tell me where to turn to get to the closest sushi restaurant.
Wow. How about that?
Oh, the Japanese are always ahead of us in these things.
They are. Thanks to Jake Reiner and to everyone who wrote us. You can comment directly on any story we air at our website, npr.org.
And you can join the fray at our blog. It's npr.org/daydreaming. Senior producer Steve Proffitt, he posts there a lot. He's here now. Thank you, Steve.
Madeline, you're very welcome.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. The government must do much more to slow housing foreclosures. That's what Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said today following this news.
The Treasury Department is considering a plan to lower mortgage rates for home buyers to as low as 4.5%. The rates would apply to 30-year fixed loans. Deborah Solomon of the Wall Street Journal broke that story yesterday. And Deborah, the plan is still in the development stage. I don't think Treasury is actually commenting on whether or not they're going to go ahead with that. How real is it then?
I think it's pretty real. Secretary Paulson has made it clear that he thinks bringing down mortgage rates is the key to ending sort of the rot in the housing market. With prices falling, people are continuing to be foreclosed on, and he sees bringing down mortgage rates as a way to not only end foreclosures but get more people back into the housing market, which will bring up the prices of homes and maybe stabilize the housing market a bit.
Some people are quoted as saying that this could get rid of half of the housing inventory out there.
Well, I'm not sure if we know how much inventory it might get rid of, but it obviously is going to, if you can get a cheaper loan, you can afford a bigger mortgage and you can afford a more expensive house. That will bring up, the prices of houses, but that's also going to make people more willing to get into the market if they can get a mortgage rate of 4.5% versus something like 6%.
So this would only be for Fannie and Freddie loans, right?
It would be for loans that are backed by Fannie, Freddie, and the Federal Housing Administration. And that's a pretty significant chunk of loans. I mean, right, most of the new loans being made right now are backed by Fannie and Freddie.
So basically, this would apply to almost any bank?
It's basically, Treasury can't bring down the rates itself. What it's going to do is encourage banks to bring down the rate to as low as 4.5% by offering to buy the securities underlying those loans at a price that's equal to 4.5%. So in other words, they're basically telling the banks, hey, if you make a loan, we're going to pay you at a rate of 4.5%, so you're guaranteed that yield. And so that's going to make banks more willing to decrease their loans to that amount.
So how would that affect the credit crunch, though? Because I think the problem now is that banks are just unwilling to provide credit to possible home buyers.
That's true. I mean, the government's trying to attack it on several fronts. They're trying to, you know, loosen credit in a number of ways. This particular plan, they think, would help loosen credit by essentially guaranteeing that they would buy these loans, the securities underlying the loans, from the bank. So that might make the banks more willing to lend.
Now, this would only apply to new home loans, right? Not refinancing?
Exactly. It doesn't apply to refinancing. And I think some people are going to find that, a sticking point, considering there are a lot of folks out there who are going to lose their homes if they can't refinance into a better situation. Treasury sees this as a way to stabilize home prices so that if your home is worth $150,000 today, it will potentially increase, but it won't decrease if they can stabilize things, so you won't be at risk, as much at risk of losing your home. Some people don't agree that this is a good strategy, but this is what Treasury thinks is going to help.
But it would take a while for that to, for any of the stabilization to take effect after
yes.
this.
Yeah. I don't think this is a quick fix. Although, you know, I guess if people already were starting to, like, cancel their home loans and wait for this program to start. So I think you may see some, you know, immediate impact in terms of more people wanting to get into the market to buy loans. But you obviously have to have banks willing to make the loans. And I don't think this is going to be a quick process. And also, we don't know for sure that Treasury is going to do it. They're still just talking about it.
Deborah Solomon is a writer for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you.
Thank you.
More than 50 years ago, Eli Bro took a $25,000 loan and started a company that built affordable homes. He went on to become one of the country's wealthiest men. He's now worth over $6 billion, and he spends much of that money on art.
Art is not a good investment, in my view. If you're a real collector, all that happens when it goes up in value is you pay more for insurance. So we don't look at it from an economic point of view.
So it may seem strange that Eli Broad recently said he'd give $30 million to the Museum of Contemporary Art here in L.A. The museum, known as MoCA, has been facing some serious financial troubles. When I sat down with Eli Broad at his offices earlier this week, he said he'd give the money only if the museum met certain conditions. No merging with other institutions, no selling any of its collection.
They've got to reconstitute the board with people they're going to step up to their responsibilities as trustees, and they're going to probably have to reduce their budget, but not their programs.
You've set these parameters for MoCA in order for you to contribute your share of $30 million. What if they don't meet their end of the bargain? Would you let the museum fail?
Well, no one wants it to fail, and I think there are people out there that are going to step up to the plate and help. To me, failure is not an option.
During times like these times that we're living in now, there's all sorts of people asking for bailouts, for help. You've got the big three automakers in trouble. You've got failing banks. And here you said you will share all of this money, $30 million, with the museum. Why extend to that particular business?
Again, I was a founding chairman. I feel an obligation. And I think in times like these, we do need the arts to really lift our spirits.
Can you give an example maybe of how a piece of art might fill that goal? A lot of people, just to play devil's advocate, might say people are losing their homes to foreclosure. What is a piece of art going to do? What would you say?
Well, I think if one goes to a performance, whether it's a theater, symphony, or museum, and sees an exhibition, it lets your mind get away from the economic trauma we're all living in. It lifts our spirits.
Is there a particular piece of art? You have so many in your collection, but is there one you can think of now where you look at it and you might see hope in what otherwise might look like a dour time to some?
Well, we've got a number of things at home, and the one work when I go through our front door where I love is Jeff Koons' Bunny. It's polished stainless steel made to look like a blown-up balloon bunny. That makes me smile.
You've set out this challenge for MoCA. You've said, here, I'll help you with this money, but you've got to make some changes. What advice would you give to the rest of this country, other failing businesses out there right now?
I think everyone has to recognize that we're in a different era. It means budgets have to be cut. We've got to have contingency plans, and we've got to ride it out. But I must say, this is a worse situation since the Great Depression, without any doubt in my mind.
Is there a silver lining in this? Have you seen any difference in prices dropping? Has that helped you maybe acquire things that you wanted to acquire?
Well, as I was leaving the recent auction at Sotheby's, Carol Vogel, New York Times, followed me in the elevator and said, "You haven't bought anything in years at auction. Why are you doing this?" I said, "Well, it's half price sale." And frankly, I'm pleased that prices are lower because it allows collectors who are not interested in an investment medium to build collections that end up being shown to a broader public in museums and elsewhere.
Eli Broad, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Good being with you today.
I spoke with philanthropist Eli Broad at his Broad Foundation office in Los Angeles. This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Madeline Brand. In a few minutes on the program, just beneath the bright lights of Las Vegas lies an underground culture, people living in the city's sprawling storm drain system.
First, though, in the small town of St. John's, Arizona, an 8-year-old boy is accused of double homicide. Police say the child shot his father and another man with a .22 caliber rifle. The story you're about to hear about his case may be disturbing to some listeners because the accused is a minor. You will not hear his name. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Renee Gattel reports.
On the evening of November 5th, 29-year-old Vincent Romero and his roommate Timothy Romans were found shot to death at Romero's home in St. John's, a small town in eastern Arizona. Police allege that Romero's own son, an 8-year-old boy, was the shooter. The linchpin in their case is a videotaped interrogation that prosecutors released to the public. The video shows the young boy sitting cross-legged in a stuffed easy chair. His story is confusing and disconnected, but at one point he tells two officers that he came home from school and found his father lying on the floor with blood on him.
And I ran and I said, "Dad, Dad," and I went upstairs. And I saw him.
And you saw him?
Okay.
And then what?
There's blood all over his face, I think.
There's no attorney present. His mother isn't there either. Over the course of the hour-long video, the boy changes his story many times over. But eventually, he tells the officers that he shot his father.
I think I shot my dad because he was suffering, I think I thought I needed suffering.
Okay.
So I might have shot him.
That makes sense.
I didn't want him to suffer.
He then says he reloaded the rifle and shot the roommate. Police have charged the boy as a minor with two counts of first-degree murder. Because the child is so young, this is an unusual case that raises a host of legal issues. One of the biggest questions here is whether or not an 8-year-old is legally competent to stand trial. John Hollebeek is a psychologist in Tempe who often evaluates children for juvenile court. He says a child this young probably doesn't know enough about the justice system.
He may have some bare-bones understanding of the court process, but isn't likely to be able to plan out the implications of decisions that he might make legally. He may not fully understand the long-term implications of decisions that he's making.
If he's found not competent now, the criminal charges could either be dismissed entirely or dismissed and then brought back again when the child is 15. There are few legal precedents. In 1996, a 6-year-old in Richmond, California, was accused of attempted murder for trying to kill a neighbor's baby. In that case, the charges were eventually dropped, and the boy was placed in a residential treatment program. In St. John's, the 8-year-old's defense attorney, Ron Wood, says talking to the boy now about the case is challenging.
I have a client who is 8 years old. His feet don't touch the floor. He still believes in Santa Claus. And so it's very difficult to try and explain some extremely complicated and adult circumstances to a young man.
Some experts believe police overreached by questioning the boy without an attorney present. Police say his mother gave them her permission. Regardless, Wood says the video doesn't prove anything.
You can make an 8-year-old say whatever you want. So that's where I'm coming from, and they're going to have to show me the rest of it.
The rest of it, he says, is forensic evidence, gun residue, fingerprints, DNA. That's what Wood says is missing from the state's case. Prosecutors for Apache County did not respond to NPR's request for interviews. The St. John's Police Department and the Apache County Sheriff's Office also declined to comment. The case has made national and international headlines. In this appearance on ABC's Good Morning America, the boy's mother, Erin Bloomfield, says her son had a good relationship with his father.
He did a lot with him. He you know, they did everything together. He loved his dad.
In recent days, there are signs the prosecution is changing its approach. Over the weekend, they offered the boy a plea deal. What's in the offer hasn't been made public. The child's attorney says he's waiting for the state to turn over forensic evidence and for competency evaluations of the child to be completed. Then he says he'll sit down with the boy and explain the situation to him as best he can. For NPR News, I'm Renee Gattell.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. Pop quiz time. You are a public school teacher. You have, let's say, $300 to spend on printing tests. You need $500. What do you do? Well, joining us now is Tom Farber. He's a math teacher at Rancho Bernardo High School near San Diego, and he faced this conundrum. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Madeline.
Well, what did you do?
I decided to take matters in my own hands and decide to raise the funds that I need to get the materials that the kids need. The budget wasn't going to change. The only thing is it was going to get worse. I decided that I should advertise on my test, and I said, well, if you would like to put a quote or an ad at the bottom of my test, then it'd be kind of a mutual. They help the kids, and then I help them get a little bit of PR out of it.
And so the parents, they responded well?
Oh, absolutely. On back-to-school night, I had one parent gave me a $100 check, and she said, I hope this gets you started. And I actually had a lot of good comments saying that's very creative and thinking outside of the box. And I've actually gotten emails from parents and one from my school district saying, you know, I'm glad somebody's finally speaking up and saying that parents are having a tough time footing the bill for things that should have been paid for through their tax dollars and paid through the school system.
And what do the kids say? I mean, aren't they kind of bombarded by advertising all day long when they're not in school?
They really like the quotes, and they actually look forward to them. I've had students say, hey, what's going to be the next quote? And I say, oh, you have to wait.
Like what? What are some of the quotes?
One is from Vaclav Havel. He's a ex-Czech president. And basically, it says for kids to surround themselves by people who seek the truth and then run from the people who have claimed they have found it. That's one of the quotes. I talked to the parents and I said, you know, everything's got to be non-offensive. It has to be a, definitely acceptable for high school students. It can't be anything that's controversial.
So how much money have you raised?
You know, right now I've raised $350, but I've been receiving numerous offers in the past week.
Have you encountered any resistance at all, either from your bosses there at the school or from the community in general, parents, students?
No. I've had complete support through the school from my principal to the superintendent of the school district. I've got a great letter from him just of support. If this economic times and the budget cuts that we are facing are draconian, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, I would never have thought I would have to do something like this. It wouldn't even been registered. But now I think my idea or ideas that are similar to mine, I think are going to be a little bit more acceptable or at least thrown out there. The community is so used to spending money and putting money into not just schools, but in a lot of infrastructure, that I think there's going to have to be more of a partnership between businesses and public facilities, whether it's a library, whether it's a school, to fix some of the problems we have.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Tom Farber teaches calculus at Rancho Bernardo High School. That's near San Diego, California. This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Nevada has one of the highest rates of homelessness in the nation. In the city of Las Vegas, more than 14,000 people live on the streets. That's according to recent estimates.
Though you probably could go a whole weekend in Vegas and never see signs of a crisis. It's really a matter of knowing where to look.
Adam Burke made the journey into one unlikely homeless encampment. He brings us this story.
We begin with a well-worn Vegas cliche, the sounds of slot machines on a busy casino floor. Tourists, blackjack tables, cocktail waitresses in impossibly tiny outfits. If you can afford the price of admission, an elevator could take you to more vice and excess upstairs, rooftop pools and lavish suites. But what if there were an elevator that went downward? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. Let's just say there is. That you could descend below the sunken lounges, past kitchens and utility closets, through layers of concrete, until you reach the hidden matrix of tunnels beneath the strip, the storm drains.
So yeah, now we're moving underneath Caesar's Palace, walking underneath kind of the main property there. My name is Matthew O'Brien. I've been exploring these storm drains for more than 5 years. I think I know these storm drains better than anyone who doesn't actually live in them. And I know the storm drain system probably, and this is nothing to brag about, but probably better than anyone else.
There are over 300 miles of underground tunnels that crisscross beneath the city. In 2007, Matt O'Brien published a book about them.
This is one of the kind of the creepier areas of the storm drain system. Very remote, wet, extremely dark.
It's after 9 p.m. on a weekday night. We're wading through the muck and gravel that blankets this tunnel floor. We arrive at a chamber where the tunnel opens wide. The plump, almost illegible cursive of graffiti lettering covers the walls. Beautiful colors and designs.
So this is one of the underground art galleries that I discovered down in the storm drains. Basically, you walk in about a half mile in pitch dark, and you have artwork going down the walls that goes down for about a half mile.
Ahead, the tunnel devours our flashlight beams. I keep hearing noises that make me stop and shine the light back in the other direction.
There's always the butterflies. There's always that apprehension when you walk into a storm drain, just because even if you've been in the drain the day before, it doesn't mean it's going to be the same environment, you know, coming down the next day. I've even met people down in the drains who are really cool one day, and then you come back the next day and it's not cool, you know, all of a sudden. They'll tell you to screw off or kind of reach for their shank or their self-defense weapon and make it clear they don't want to talk to you today, so.
Over the years, O'Brien has met more than 100 people who live in the tunnels. They're scattered in pockets across the city. We head away from the trickling water, down a side channel that stays dry most of the time. The ceiling gets lower, the corridor narrower, and the air becomes stale with the faint scent of body odor and human waste. We arrive at an encampment, a kind of cardboard lean-to.
Yo, anyone here?
Continuing on, we come upon two men sitting in the glow of candlelight. One of them, with a shag of greasy hair, is slumped on a couch. In front of him, on a makeshift coffee table, are a few hypodermic needles. The other man is better groomed. He's wearing a button-down shirt and a decent pair of slacks. To my relief, they both know Matt O'Brien.
Hey, man, check this out.
Thanks for the Thanksgiving thing.
Brian and Steve haven't seen Matt since he was down here last Thanksgiving.
We came back and there was Thanksgiving dinner on each of our beds. Big turkey and stuffing, and it was pretty good.
Steve is the well-dressed one. He's 42, grew up in Las Vegas, and he makes his living at casinos around town, doing what's known as silver mining, which means he looks for credits left behind on slot machines.
And I'll start at Harrah's, and depending on how I feel, I'll go to either the Venetian or the Mirage. A lot depends on how I look, because those are two very hard places. If you don't look right, they'll stop you and they'll watch you. It's always busy at Harrah's, so you're able to walk through the casino without, you know, drawing much attention to yourself.
To blend in, you need to dress the part. Steve has a rack of button-down shirts and slacks. He takes us to his quarters, cardboard walls enclosing a queen-size bed, a dresser, even a makeshift shower.
2.5-gallon water jugs. Try to keep these two full right here, and you know, pull the knobs out. I got all the supplies and stuff. Shaving cream, shampoo.
You got a little mirror right there?
Yep, got my mirror there. My little stand here. Water overflow bucket. Like I said, try to live comfortable. If I gotta be out here.
Steve says his luck varies. The night before, he'd visited several casinos and things hadn't been going so well.
Then I went to the Bellagio and was walking through going, darn, this is just going to be a hopeless case. I turned the corner in one area of the casino and there on the machine was $116. Nobody around, so I hit the cash out button, took it, cashed it out, and that was the end of my night. You know, it helped me out today. I ate very well today. I had a late breakfast last night and I still got about $50 left.
But Steve is addicted to methamphetamine and gambling, so holding on to money can be difficult.
That's what I'm trying not to do, is gamble my money away anymore. And as far as the drugs, I'm trying to slowly get myself, you know, to where I don't crave it. Tonight I'm taking it easy. I figure I'll just call it an early night and see what I can do tomorrow.
After a while in the Las Vegas storm drains, it's easy to forget that directly overhead is a very different world. Matt O'Brien is often struck by the contrast.
You can be in the Hard Rock Casino, which is one of the hipper, kind of younger, richer hotel casinos in town, kind of celebrity watching, people watching, betting $1,000 per hand in a game of blackjack. And right underneath the Hard Rock is one of the worst skid rows I've ever seen in my life.
Broken bottles, hypodermic needles strewn all over the tunnel floor. People passed out.
And last time I was down in there, I actually saw some blankets and like teddy bears and stuffed animals and stuff, which gave me the impression that a young kid was living down in there with a mom or dad or both.
That contrast is what kept O'Brien coming back to the tunnels long after the book was finished. He brings food and clothing to people like Brian and Steve on a regular basis. And the tunnels have become a kind of refuge for him, too, from the city.
When work wasn't going all that great, or my relationship with my girlfriend wasn't that great, I would just strap on the boots and grab the flashlight and just walk a tunnel to get away from everything above ground. You know, in some ways, there are certain things about underground Vegas that I prefer to above ground Vegas.
Once, we walked a long tunnel that led to the dark recesses of a parking structure. A little further, and we were back in a crush of pedestrians on the Las Vegas Strip. Matt O'Brien looked a little out of place, with his dark clothing, knit cap, muddy boots, still clutching a heavy-duty flashlight. Then, an idea popped in my head. Maybe O'Brien should become the official guide to the storm drains. Visitors could explore the underbelly of Las Vegas. They would meet real, live human casualties of a city that trades on excess. Then again, that might be too real. Besides, surveying all the tourists, no one was checking out the gutters. Everyone was looking up at the flickering lights. For NPR News, I'm Adam Burke.
Back now with Day to Day and a little holiday cheer from Brooklyn. New Yorker Vincent Van Ren has been selling Christmas trees since he was 16 years old. He's been on the same Brooklyn street corner every holiday season for 3 decades. Producer Lizzie Cooper Davis stopped by recently.
We always sold things in the street. We sold cutlery sets at one time. We sold fruit. And the next step was trees.
Is that you, Santa Claus?
My name is Vincent Van Ren. I'm selling trees here on the corner of Atlantic Avenue and Clinton Street in Brooklyn. And I started this place about 30 years ago, and I'm still here. Same spot. We get them from farmers in Nova Scotia, North Carolina, Vermont. We come about December 1st, and then we leave December 24th. And we sell about 2,000 trees. People are very nice. Everybody's happy when they come to buy a tree. Sometimes they're not nice to each other. The husbands and wives get into fights, get nasty with each other. Because she wants a big, big tree, and he doesn't want to spend the money. He wants a little tiny tree, and she calls him a cheap ass. See, it's a very interesting thing with Christmas trees is there was a city ordinance passed in the 1920s, right after the Depression, that people who set up Christmas tree stands can sell Christmas trees, and you don't need any license, you're not responsible to the Department of Consumer Affairs, and it's basically unreported income. But in those days, you can imagine there was mom and pop stores selling trees for maybe a dollar or two, maybe 10 or 15 trees. Now you have people bringing in thousands of trees where we don't have to declare it to anyone. Well, I do a lot of traveling. I travel around the world a lot. I'm an adventure traveler, seeking high adventure in different countries. I've lived in India, Egypt, Morocco, Ecuador, Peru, the Himalaya Mountains in Nepal and Tibet. And now I'm leaving for Guatemala right after this. There's two volcanoes that are really exploding a lot of lava, so I want to photograph them. No, we don't get cold. Down off wool, L.L. Bean underwear, stuff like that. The Buddhists in the Himalayas, they actually can sleep out in the snow and create so much heat that their blankets actually start steaming.
Do you have a Christmas tree?
No, I'm a Buddhist.
And that story came to us from the NPR series, Hearing Voices.
If you're like most of us, hardly a day goes by without some bad news showing up in the mail. So we turn to our musician contributor, David Was. He has some music for 401ks, tunes you might want to consider queuing up before opening that statement from your stockbroker or retirement plan, or worse.
Is there any melody on earth that could take the sting out of foreclosure proceedings? Personally, hearing Bobby McFerrin's treacly refrain makes me want to clamp on the ankle weights and head for a murky swamp. But that's just me.
Don't worry, be happy.
Music hath charms to soothe a savage breast, William Congreve said famously, to soften rocks or bend a knotted oak. Most people think he said beast instead of breast, like playing Mozart for King Kong would make him roll over and scratch his hairy belly. Theologian Karl Barth explained that Mozart's music sounds unburdened and thus unburdens us. So maybe it would pay to keep the old CD player spinning in case Bigfoot crashes through the French doors on a stormy winter night. That and a big glass of milk. Then again, one would have to acknowledge that music can stir as well as soothe, turning well-raised teens into mosh pit maniacs at the drop of a distorted guitar. Or think back on all those Hollywood movies where savage primitives dipped their arrows in bubbling sterno while some leopard-skinned Buddy Rich banged out a war beat on a hollowed-out tree stump. Ookum boogum, boys, let's do us some maiming and killing. Let's confuse the issue a little further by dropping a little neurochemistry into the equation. According to Daniel Levitin's book, This Is Your Brain on Music, a cascade of neural regions becomes activated while listening to either Mozart or the Sex Pistols, eventually resulting in increased dopamine levels and thus an improvement in mood. So next time you're reading your monthly mutual fund statement and are considering popping a Paxil, try the second movement of Mahler's Fourth Symphony instead. But it couldn't be that easy, could it? Replacing hard reality and shrunken equity with mellifluous melodies? I'm reminded of fellow madman Friedrich Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy and the Genealogy of Morals, wherein he argues that the Greeks of the Golden Age enjoyed dark tragedies in the midst of their flourishing civilization. It was out of their strength and optimism that they could chew on the tough gristle of human hardship. Conversely, the age of reason and philosophy ensued when the great Greek experiment in democracy was on its last legs. Does that mean that Socrates was the Dr. Phil of the Acropolis, a kind of epistemological Muzak? following Nietzsche's prescription, maybe it is what's hardest to bear that emboldens us to decisive action and right living. If that's the case, fix yourself a stiff gin and Windex and crank up some modern classical music, something like Krzysztof Penderecki's Brutal Life, a sonic landscape so harrowing and bleak you'll be happy to just have a head of hair and a heartbeat once it's over. Like Freddie said, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
David Was, half of the musical duo Was Not Was.
In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Don't worry, be happy.